Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within the different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer. I'm here with Lynette, and I'm going to say Lynette Cox, but I want you to pronounce your full name just so I make sure I got it.
Kalfani Cox. You got it.
Kalfani. And what does Kalfani mean, or where's that from?
It's a Swahili name. And it was for my first marriage. My husband had a Swahili name. He was African American, but he actually changed his last name to Kalfani. But the more important part now that I'm remarried, that part.
By the way, if we need to edit that out, I'm happy to edit it out.
You can totally keep it
in. Okay. That's funny. All right. Well, you and I met a month or so ago through a mutual friend. So I've gotten to know you a little bit. But Lynette, I was actually pleasantly surprised, not surprised, but I was not often do people have Wikipedia pages. So look, you're the real deal here.
Oh, gosh.
I don't know how you get that, but
I got a little brand going here. I don't know. But for 22 years, I've had a financial education company that my husband Earl and I run called the MoneyCoach.net, our LLC. But, you know, I did have a background in media and have, you know, been blessed to do some high profile work. So I was a Wall Street Journal reporter. I was a CNBC correspondent. And again, for the past 22 years, I've had this financial education company and my own personal brand, tied, of course, with my professional work that I do, is called the Money Coach. So everybody knows me as the Money Coach because I teach people across the country and now increasingly across the world about personal finances, about just improving their money management skills in some capacity, whether that's talking about investing, retirement planning, managing credit and debt, you know, saving for your kids' college education or whatever. In the course of my work for the past couple of decades, I've done a number of things, you know, become a New York Times bestselling author, been on, you know, 1,000+ TV shows, got interviewed by Oprah, just whatever. Those things thus led to the wiki page, I think is but honestly, the best title, the best roles that I have are wife and mom, a devoted sister. I like to think I'm a good daughter, I hope, if my mom is listening. But, you know, we've had the career successes, the career setbacks and failures, but a number of wins that they only highlight the good things, the wins on something like Wikipedia.
You just did a great, great high-level intro. So why don't we take a few minutes and weave together some of those things that you just talked about, but start with where'd you grow up? Where did you go to school? And then at that point, then kind of weave us through your career into what you're doing today. And I might jump in and ask questions along the way.
So my parents were both from New York. My dad from Harlem. My dad was a shoeshine man from Harlem. My mom was raised in the Bronx. They also lived in Brooklyn at one point. My parents never went to college. My dad, you know, was in the military, but then got out and, you know, he certainly didn't get the benefit of, say, a GI Bill to go, say, live in, I don't know, Levittown in New York or something and get a mortgage underwritten or anything like that. So my parents were quite low income to moderate income. But long story short, my dad actually decided that he wanted to become an actor of all things. He moved from New York to Los Angeles. And so and my parents had five daughters together when they were married, I was actually raised in Los Angeles. Even though I was born in New York, I was like, I don't know, 1 year old or so when my parents moved to Los Angeles, California. So I ended up getting raised in Southern California. My parents divorced when I was about seven. My mom had to really do a lot, you know, as a single mom to take care of five girls on her own, work two jobs all the time, you know, just really try to make ends meet. She always told us, as did my dad, you can do anything. You can be anything. Work hard, put your best effort forth, and you can do anything. And so because both of our parents instilled that kind of ethos and philosophy in us, we did, all five of us. We all sort of statistically at least defied the odds. So we had five African-American girls who were really the product of a single home, a single mom, who did all go to college. And then three of us went on and got our graduate degrees. The same three of us became business owners. So I went to University of California, Irvine undergrad. That's where I got my bachelor's degree in English. And then I went to grad school at USC in Los Angeles, and that's where I got my master's in journalism, in broadcast journalism specifically. But I had a kind of a tripartite curriculum there with print journalism, broadcast journalism, and learning a bit about PR as well, which I had no idea at the time, but it would serve me well in what I'm doing now as an entrepreneur. But I'm sharing all that to say, basically, definitely was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth by any stretch of the imagination. And honestly, a lot of, you know, sort of how I grew up, because my mother was on public assistance. We had food stamps. You know, there were times when the lights were disconnected. There were times when we moved around from one apartment to another. My mother reminded me when I was an adult of a time when we were what we call now squatting, essentially, like she could not afford to pay. But there was nobody around. So she had us there in an apartment just existing, really. And so it was tough, you know, economically, it definitely was tough growing up. I grew up in an era of busing in Southern California. I don't know if the rest of the country all had this, but certainly in Southern California, LAUSD, the Los Angeles Unified School District, essentially they would put on school buses, kids in, you know, lower income, predominantly communities of color, mostly Black and Latino, some Asian as well, but for the most part, predominantly Black and Latino students, and bus us to wealthy, predominantly white neighborhoods. And so, yeah, I grew up and I saw two worlds. I saw my life and my existence in my neighborhood where everybody lived in an apartment. And in my family, we had a two-bedroom apartment my entire life until I was a young adult. My mom was in one bedroom. The five of us girls in another bedroom, literally two sets of bunk beds, if you can picture that. So my sister Cheryl on the top bunk bed, my sister Debbie on the bottom bunk bed, then another bunk bed set, my sister Denise at the top bunk bed on that one, and me and my sister Hope, the youngest.
I can do math, so I was waiting for the two. Where was the double up? So you were one of the double ups.
It was me and my sister Hope, the last two. I'm number four and Hope was number five among us five girls. So yeah, all of us in one bedroom and my mom in the other bedroom. I'm just sort of painting a picture here that this is how it was like growing up in Los Angeles. But I saw another world where when I was bused, I went to Brentwood, California. I went to Pacific Palisades, California. So I went to middle school and to high school in very affluent, again, predominantly white areas. And so when I went to Canyon Elementary School in Brentwood, and when I went to Paul Revere Junior High School in Brentwood, and when I went to Pacific Palisades High School, it was like, oh, wow, everybody here has a house, the pool, the you know, they would say, my mom is an engineer. My dad is a doctor. Or what do your parents do? Kind of thing. And I was like, honestly, I was ashamed. I was like, I wouldn't say, oh, my dad is a shoeshine man. I would focus on the acting side. And for sure, my dad, like to this day, I was in the hospital at a doctor's appointment, not hospital, I was at a doctor's appointment. And I turned and I looked on the ad in the room where I was just waiting. And it was a picture of my dad and his wife. Because my dad, to this day, not only did he have some very high profile acting roles and what he did and whatnot, he still markets himself. He does brand deals. My dad is 80 something years old. And he's still, and I'm like, all right, dad, you know what? So, but anyway, instead of me saying, oh, my dad is a shoeshine man, I was like, oh, my dad is an actor. Did you see E.T.? The movie E.T.? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, you know, the cop who was like, stop the kids when they were about to ride off on the bike and go up into the sky with E.T.? He had one line. He was like, hey, you kids, what are you doing? Stop. You know, I was like, that's my dad. That's Michael Darrell. You know,
that's pretty cool, though.
It was pretty cool. So, you know, I'm getting into a little of the backstory here.
Well, can I stop you for one second? So you grew up with a mom and dad who said you can do anything. I'm assuming the implied, and maybe they said it, is they believe in you as well. I'm assuming that. And so how much of who you are today are the words of your mom and dad? And how much of who you are today is being able to see a vision of what could be because of what you just described to us?
For me, both elements are enormously important in terms of the person that I've become. Not only because I had two parents who instilled in me the idea that hard work could lead to success and anything that I wanted to achieve, but also because of what I saw, even the things that I thought that were, again, embarrassing, wrong, or just kind of like not in alignment with very narrow, limited vision that I had at the time. Because I later realized when I became an entrepreneur that the first entrepreneur that I ever saw was my dad, and that my dad showed me a model for what it could mean to have freedom to work for yourself. Now, he wasn't just sitting there, you know, shining all the shoes himself. He ultimately built a series of stands across Southern California, had, you know, many employees working for him at car washes, at hotels, et cetera. But he showed me this model for what it meant like to be in business for yourself at that scale. But it never even dawned on me. My dad is an entrepreneur. He's the first one that I saw until later, decades later, right? So I think seeing that model in action and understanding my dad's insistence, all honest work is good work. And that it does not matter if you are a street sweeper, a laundry cleaner, a shoeshine person, a CEO, an engineer, a teacher. If you put your heart and soul into it and your passion into it and you work hard at it and you do right by people, that makes you great at what you do. You know, it's kind of like when Martin Luther King Jr. said, we can all be great because we can all serve, right? So it's about understanding I'm serving when I'm offering a product, a service, you know, it could be anything, an app, a tool. But if I'm trying to help others in life, I'm serving them. And that's good work. That's honest work.
So again, I don't want to stereotype, but I'm going to say some stuff. And if I'm offensive, then just slap me. Look, you could have grown up in that environment and had a mindset of whatever, embitterment, rage, anger, unfairness, whatever all the things could be. But you chose not to, and instead said, hey, there's a path forward. I'm going to move forward. I'm going to college. I'm going to do this kind of stuff. What do you think the difference between you and somebody who grows in that situation and can't get out of it?
I've given a lot of thought to this. And honestly, it's not particularly tough. I think that first, it's important to acknowledge that there's really not much difference between me and many of the people that I grew up with. Now, I will say this, in my circle, like I look at my husband, Earl, who was raised in New York, a very blue collar black background, a very stable kind of home environment, but a different one, mostly raised by his grandparents, but a different type of upbringing. Most of his friends and younger colleagues were blue collar. They worked for city transportation, cops, firefighters, things like that. Almost nobody I knew and grew up with in Los Angeles fit that mold. Pretty much everybody I knew went to college. Everybody became doctors, became entrepreneurs, became nurses, became teachers, did something in the professional space. We certainly had people who fell between the cracks. We certainly had people who didn't aspire to, you know, whether it's business ownership or something else. They did their roles and did them very well. Some of us did perhaps more high profile careers than others. Some did perhaps more lucrative careers than others. But generally speaking, honestly, there's not much difference between me and other people. Now, where I see like a big gap where, say, somebody didn't go to college, where someone didn't, I won't even say assimilate, but sort of didn't integrate into society in a way that they became like a productive member of society, air quotes being used here. I think that the difference on those front are twofold primarily. One, it was the people in their lives, whether or not they had parental guidance, sometimes two parents, or just a family structure, or close friends, or mentors, or teachers, somebody who could put them on the right track. So like I had excellent teachers, even when I was in my own neighborhood in the predominantly Black neighborhood where I live, even as an elementary student, I remember my third grade teacher, Miss Kendricks. She asked my mom if she could skip me, because she said, your daughter is really, really smart here. Can we test her? So they did an IQ test with me and all these things. They wanted to skip me. And my mother said, absolutely not. Well, as it turns out, one of the teacher's assistant, a guy named Mr. Perot, he was the one who administered and did the test and all that. I later on campus at USC, when I went to grad school, just walking down the campus, I see his face and I immediately recognize him. Mm. And I'm like, Mr. Perot? And he said, Lynette, and I think he might have called my maiden name. And I said, yes. And I could not believe it. But there he was on the campus at USC. I mean, wow. Talk about a full circle, you know. On the one hand, it's the people. It's the structure in your life, and it's the resources, because your network is absolutely a resource, obviously, as you know. It's who's your circle, who's in your sphere of influence, who's influencing you. And so perhaps some did not have that. And all of my sisters were like go-getters, and were, you know, my sisters above me were like, when I was an undergrad, I was so ready to get out of college. They were like, a BA is a dime a dozen. You have to get a graduate degree. And I was like, are you kidding me? No, I'm done. This is enough. You know? They encouraged and insisted that I go to grad school. And of course, they were right. Separately, the other thing that distinguishes us is systemic barriers that some of us have faced and that we've encountered and dealt with in different ways that others might not have been able to overcome or kind of surmount those barriers. So I absolutely believe in like individual responsibility and the idea that nobody owes you anything. You have to hustle hard. You have to work. You have to put your grind in here, right? But at the same time, I also fully recognize that in the system that we live in, this capitalistic system that I've completely taken advantage of and love and leverage, the system provides barriers and boosts. So depending on where you are, a talented person, somebody like me, might be seen a little bit more. They might say, look at that smart young lady. I'm going to give her more opportunity. I'm going to give her access. I'm going to open up my network. I'm going to provide funding and whatever. But I might have been given a boost, whereas some other people might have been hit with a barrier or had some kind of a systemic barrier erected that they couldn't get beyond.
So I love the way you said that. And we did not prep for this. I think I've told you this, that we've talked about this. I have a deep passion for men and women who've been incarcerated. And what's a couple things. One, the family unit, and whether it's whatever exactly that family unit looks like, at one level, I don't care, but it's having a family unit of some sort is just totally blown up today in a lot of cases. And in fact, what I see is now, after these men and women get released, full transparency, as everybody knows, it's more men, because there's more men in prison. What you're literally trying to do is fix or repair damages of what the family unit should have been doing all along. And then, of course, the prison system clearly didn't help. That's one thing. But then the other thing you said that is so critical, and I've said the exact same thing, and I don't want to get political, but just for the sake of this discussion, you gave an answer that the far right would give and a far left would give, which is pull up your bootstraps. That's kind of the far right. And yet there's truth to that. And then on the far left is like, it's the system and there's truth to that. And so to me, I'm always like, look, it's both. You absolutely have to do both. Now, if I was pushed to the mat, I would say, from my experience working with human beings, but specifically inmates, here's what I know. Unless they take responsibility, I don't care what system's in place, they're still not going to make it. So I err more heavy on the personal responsibility, but 100% agree with you that there are systems and barriers that are out there that we need to fight. Anyways, I love the way you said that because it's like you've been in my head. So I hope I'm right because I love what you're saying.
Me too. And I do believe you need both. And yes, it's like intrinsic motivation. You know, I was talking to my husband about just exercise, for example. So we have we're going back to Africa at the end of October. And I told him, because this is our fourth trip to Africa this year. Oh, you know, I put on a couple of pounds eating through, you know, not only Africa, but Europe and in Jamaica and Mexico. We've spent a lot of time traveling the last year. Again, we're empty nesters. And we're like, yes, this is what we did for 20 years to get these kids out the nest. And now we're enjoying ourselves. So I told him, I said, nope, I want to go back. I got a couple pounds to lose. I want to be the same. When I went to Rwanda in February, I want to be right back at that same weight, you know? And so he was like, and he knows that I love to walk. We walk by the lake of our house and all that. And he said, okay, yeah, I'm going to also do it with you because same for me. But he didn't. The truth is that he didn't. I said to him, when I'm popping up out of the bed and I'm like, I have to go. I'm going to do my walk. Because at the end of the day, I have to take personal responsibility. He can't go left, right, left, right, left, right for me and move my legs. Yep. And I can't blame the system of marriage that, oh, my husband didn't do it. Or he was saying, oh, let's cuddle in the bed longer. Or here, let's eat these potato chips or whatever. You know, I don't know. But just the idea is that I have to take personal responsibility. I have to say, this is on me and only I can do this. And if I start And if I take that initiative first, then the rest of things will fall into place, or at least that's my hope and expectation. So I totally hear you on that. Yeah. And I do believe in accountability and in personal responsibility first. I know it's harder, easier. You know, again, I know that for some people, the systemic barriers get removed, kind of like if they set themselves up for success. Like in my kitchen, I don't bring junk food in the kitchen. I don't bring it in the house. And that's one way I don't have to struggle with willpower issues, because cookies are not quickly available to me because they're not here. They're not in my house. It's that kind of thinking, like, and some can do that a little bit more than others.
Yeah. And I really see it. I mean, this is true whether you're incarcerated or not. It's so dramatic in prison, where when the individual finally surrenders and finally says, you know what, I'm going to not make excuses, breakthroughs happen. It's to your point. It's there's still the same system is in place. Again, doesn't mean that it's going to be easy, but I see change. All the time. And in fact, I think one of the reasons why why God planted that into my heart is I get inspired by, I love seeing people change, progress, and whatnot. And so when you go into a prison system, eventually the illusion comes off their eyes that what I've done doesn't work. The problem with the rest of the world, we're out here, we think we're free as a bird. And yet the reality is our own mind and whatnot is keeping us shackled. And it just takes us till God puts you on your knee and you finally say, I surrender. But once you surrender, it is amazing how, again, not that all of a sudden it's perfect, but in some people's case, it's like a rocket ship.
It totally is. And can I share, let's take this one or two more levels. I don't do a lot of coaching, despite my brand name being the Money Coach, right? My business is B2B. So again, brands hire me to you know, teach about some aspect, one to many, right? However, when I do provide one-on-one coaching services, people are at first a little shook when I tell them that one of my philosophical principles is that wherever they are financially in their life and in their journey, it's predominantly because of them. It's because of what they've done or what they failed to do. Now, I have to let some people sit with that for a while.
I get it.
A whole process, right? But the idea of someone saying, my ex-spouse, the reason I'm in debt is he bled me dry. He ruined my credit. My boss is a cheapskate. They won't pay me enough. My colleagues sabotage me on the job. The system won't let me get ahead. When you're constantly pointing outward and you're blaming the world and everybody else for everything that's going wrong with what's going on in your life, you're doing a number of things that are hurting you personally, emotionally, and financially. One is you're giving away your power. You're basically saying this person has the power over me to direct and to control my fate. I don't like that personally. I don't like anybody to control. I want my freedom. The second thing that you're doing is you're abdicating responsibility. You're putting yourself in a position where it's not up to me because it's the system. I'm just a little ping pong being moved about here, there, and everywhere. It's like, whoa. No, you have more control over this than you think. Why are you just abdicating any kind of personal responsibility and any, like, you don't have any say so in this, right? And three is when you finally do accept responsibility for all of it, for saying, I'm here because this is what I've done. If it's I'm in debt, it's because I had a shopping problem. I was a people pleaser. I tried to buy gifts and buy love. I didn't put a close eye on my finances. Or if it's I made poor investments. I gambled too much. I risked too much. I didn't take the time to be prudent and thoughtful and judicious about where I allocated capital. All of those things, whatever your situation is, then you can learn and do better for the next time. So if you constantly blame everybody else, then you, by definition, you avoid that level of reflection and self-awareness that is crucial for growth. Again, I have to sometimes let people sit with it for a while.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people be like, well, do you think I asked for my husband to come home one day and to say, I'm leaving you for a younger woman? Like, how is that my fault or whatever? And I'm like, no. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying, were there any things that you did that contributed to whatever is going on that has a financial angle tied into it? And then when people really kind of sit with it for a while, they might see that they were enablers. They might see that they were aloof, checked out. didn't keep their eye on the ball for different things, a whole set of things that they did or that they failed to do. When somebody shows me that they that an emergency or a crisis, it was a tornado, a hurricane blew my house away, and now I'm destitute, or it was a fire or something. Do I think that they caused Mother Nature's wrath? Of course not. What I will say is, did you fail to have protection in place? Mm-hmm. Did you think about having insurance, flood insurance, fire insurance? How did you protect the things that you've worked so hard to build? When they calm down after listening to, why is it my fault kind of thing, you know, then they can kind of get there. But I absolutely, that's why I believe that personal accountability and responsibility is vital. It's because ultimately it's going to empower you. Who's going to care more about your well-being and your finances than you are? No one.
You nailed it. I mean, I'm 100% on board with you. Now, let me go one step further and say, okay, so 100% agree with you. Love it. I think you can go too far the other way. When I think it is solely me doing it, then I think you can also get disillusioned that it's not just me. There are others around me who are helping me. There is, I believe, in a higher power. There's God. And so how do you dialogue that scenario when you get the narcissist who's going, it's just me. I don't take any credit. I mean, I've got a great brain. And you're like, yeah, but somebody created that brain. Somebody gave you the ability to learn. So I'm curious how you answer that or when you come across that scenario.
So great point, because we can be deluded as people, right? You know, one of my favorite verses in the Bible is Philippians 4:13, I think it is. Philippians for sure. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I might be off with the verse with chapter and verse, but
I think you're right.
But I know the language. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I love, love, love this verse. The reason I love it is, it's like if you break it down, I can. It's saying, I have the ability. I can. Not I can't. Because so many times people say, well, I can't do that, or that won't work. Or it's saying, no, I can. And it's saying, I can do. That's about action, right? That's doing is not yak, 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 yak. It's not talking. It's saying, I can be about it. I can actually take steps. I can take action steps, right? I can do all things. All is a really big word. It's not some things. It's not these things that I think I might be able to do. It's like literally everything. I can do all things through Christ. So the through, that's the, in the entire sentence there, I think that's probably the most, the last two words, these two words right here, through Christ. Who, it's not through my own efforts. It's not through my own smarts, my good actions, my own connections and my ideas. When I get inspiration, I know it's divine inspiration. I know God wastes nothing. And so increasingly, my mindset is, my job is to connect the dots. He's already given us everything that we need. He's put the right people in our lives, the right ideas, the right structures, resources, and more to accomplish the things that we need that will glorify him and that will help us to reach what we want as well. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Because a lot of times we're like, there's no way I cannot possibly do this. Like on my own and of my own accord, I literally would not have the capacity, the bandwidth, the strength to do X, Y, or Z things. But he's saying, don't worry about that. I've got you. I've got enough strength for you and everybody else on planet Earth. So I love that verse because it is a reminder that it's not by my will, my strength, my own good works or doing. It's through Christ that I'm able to do these things. And so, yeah, I think you could go too far. Just, it's like when I hear people say, oh, this person was a self-made millionaire. I'm like, really? Who is self-made? I have yet to meet somebody who was truly like an island on by themselves, who had no inheritance, no family structure, no connections, no capital, no loans, no support system, no spouse that enabled them to work like crazy. Who really became a millionaire, multimillionaire, billionaire, quote unquote, on their own? Nobody. So yeah, we can deal and put the ego in check as well and recognize the balance that's important there. And to know that even as you're considering personal accountability, the level with which you have to approach a task or a challenge or a goal to give it your best and your hardest effort, but that really it's not just about you. And it never has been and never will.
I tell you what, I don't know if we're in a counseling session, if we're in church. Let me tell you a secret. You should be on TV. You need your own financial network. You need to be a podcast. No, wow, your clarity, your precision of words and how you describe that is beautiful. And what's interesting is when you speak with that level of clarity and simplicity, it actually is very easy. Not, it's hard to do, but it's not complex.
Straightforward.
It's straightforward. And yet, we all want to put these qualifiers and, well, what about this? And I do that too. What about that? And it's like, yeah, but if you focus on this core stuff you just said, you're going to be in a pretty good spot. I mean, look, life still has challenges. Stuff still happens. That was good. That was really good. So let me jump ahead. One of the questions I love asking is, and we haven't gotten all your story, but I'm sure through this we will. How would you best describe who you are in the context of kind of where you're at in your life journey?
I think that I'm definitely at an inflection point where my husband and I both are in a massive transition and transformation that is beyond glorious. It is so nurturing, so satisfying. So we're like in our happy zone and we feel like we're just being 10x'd every level. Spiritually, our connection with one another, our relationship with our kids, we have a new grandchild, our business is thriving. It's just like, wow. It's almost as if all the blessings have just come together at once. And so we're enormously grateful and we recognize the blessing. We like pray thanksgiving prayers to say, thank you, because I don't deserve it. but it's wonderful in so many ways. So I'll share a couple of things with you. So I shared that, you know, we're empty nesters now. So a year ago, our youngest daughter, Alexis, went off to college. Our two older kids have already graduated from college. And Alexis is a sophomore, crushing it in school, doing extremely well, very happy. You know, again, all three of our kids, happy, healthy, normal, adjusted, good people. And so above everything, Earl and I, we're like, we won. Mm-hmm. We won at life. Like our mission, I want to live decades and decades more, obviously. Right. But if I did pass away tomorrow, I would definitely die a happy woman. And I would be like, I did what I was supposed to do on this earth. I raised up these three amazing human beings. And yes, there's more that I can do for them, more that I can do professionally and all of that. My number one goal, and even us in having our business, we built it as a lifestyle business for us. But now we're in that transition where it's like, oh, wow, this is really scaling and becoming so much more than we originally intended. But really, success, our metric has always been, can we keep our relationship together? Earl and I, our marriage, happy, healthy, strong as a couple? And the answer is yes, we have and we did and we continue to do so. And can we raise up these three kids and do right by them in so many ways, instill in them the values that are near and dear to our hearts, give them the tools they need to survive in this world at whatever level they choose? The answer has been like, we get to see it. I mean, I'm a young grandparent. Again, my granddaughter is just 9 months old, 10 months old now, as a matter of fact, 2 days be 10 months old. But I feel like a little bit of the wisdom of someone who's like, I this is what it was for. You know, the Bible also talks about a wise man, you know, just thinking after and leaving a legacy for their children's children and thinking generationally. And so we've been blessed to set up things for the next generation and now the next. And so it's just so gratifying. So not only are we at a point where as empty nesters, we're getting to live out our dreams. I told you initially, my husband was like, let's take a year off. Let's just go travel the world and let's, you know, do all these things. And I was like, babe, you know, we got the business and oh, there's this thing I want to do. There was a major initiative that I wanted to launch called the Financial Influencer Network. And it was really about taking what we've done, our B2B business, and scaling that with 25 other trusted authorities, 25 other financial experts like myself. And so we've done that. We've launched it and we operationally put it into effect over the last year. And it's just poof, it just took off in so many ways. And now we're like, oh, wow. So now, like I can share with you, you're the first person that I would say this to. Well, let me think. I probably shouldn't, but I will say this. I can say this. I don't even know when your podcast is going to air. I will say this. In October, this month, October 2025, we're launching a strategic partnerships division called Friends of Fin. And it's a way for us to connect with different strategic partners. But we also have another division that we'll be launching in 2026. So this is a little premature, but I don't care. I'm going to say it anyway. And it's called Fin International. And it's about spreading financial literacy globally and us connecting with different influencers who are around the world. I have my eye on some people in Rwanda. I have my eye on several people in the UK, in Jamaica, in Senegal, and elsewhere. And so one of the reasons as we travel and make our way back to Africa in a couple of weeks, I will be connecting more with people. And again, I haven't even announced it on social yet, but they did announce it on Friday, I believe. Amir did, the Association of Microfinance Institutions in Rwanda. We signed a 5-year agreement with them to promote financial literacy all across Rwanda. And I'm so excited about that.
That is so cool.
450 plus banks, credit unions, SACOs, et cetera, to really leverage the expertise and what we've done for 22 years and to share best practices and strategies and ideas for the Rwandan marketplace, which is extremely near and dear to our hearts. That's why we keep.
So here's what I need from you. I ask you one favor, and that is I would love to inspire more and more Americans to view Africa not as a charity case, but as worthy of an investment. So as you get over there and look into this, I want you to scream as loud as you can back to America and say, wake up. These men and women have value. They have skill sets. And they are worthy to be invested in.
They are absolutely worthy. And honestly, the investor misses out. You're not doing them a favor. You're actually shortchanging yourself or your investors, because the opportunities are immense. We immediately saw, this is together, us going there together, but my first time going to Africa was more than 25 years ago. I went to South Africa. I shared with you that my ex-husband, he got his PhD from Penn and he went to University of Pretoria, and he was over there for 6 months or so. And I went over there with him and got a chance to go to Durban, Tsikamba Bay, Mtata, Pretoria, you know, all around the country, and saw opportunity then, honestly. But even, of course, more now. In Rwanda, Kigali in particular, the capital there, just teeming with and the demographics are in place. If you don't know that there's 35 average age in so many countries, including in Rwanda, you think about what that trajectory means in terms of the consumer sector, investing opportunities, and more. You're just missing out. And you could be slow, you know. Michael Saylor, and I don't want to go off into this, but Michael Saylor, the CEO of Strategy, MicroStrategy, you know, obviously a Bitcoin enthusiast, and he has an expression. He says, everyone gets Bitcoin at the price that they deserve.
That's a great line.
It's basically like catch up, like mentally catch up. Like we've been proselytizing, telling you this for years and years. You could have had Bitcoin. You want to keep saying, oh, it's a Ponzi, it's a scam, Okay, keep saying that while the rest of the world moves onto the blockchain and recognizes that Bitcoin is a store of value. You can argue and you can say whatever you want to say. You know what? When you get FOMO later, fear of missing out, and you say, oh, geez, Bitcoin is 300,000 per coin or per token, you know, don't say we didn't give you an opportunity when it was at 100 or when it was at 70 or when it was at 18,000.
Oh, my gosh. If I, yes,
Africa, everybody gets Africa at the price they deserve, you know?
Oh my gosh, there's so many things there, because we just crossed 126,000 on Bitcoin this weekend. Last I saw, it was about 125,000. I'm in the financial world. I've been doing this for 27, 28 years. Everything in my being was saying, Bitcoin, don't do it. I don't know what it was. 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I finally am like, look, let me put some capital in there. And the reason why I said that is, and I didn't put huge amounts back then. I have since put more. But I knew once I put my capital there, I'm going to follow it and I'm going to learn about it. And so to me, the same thing is said about Africa. I put capital in Africa, my wife and I have. And honestly, when people push back, what I want to say is, I don't want to hear any excuses from you. I don't want to hear any of your arguments. Put some capital in and let's have an argument. But until you do, I kind of don't want to hear your opinion. I mean, I'm being a bit facetious.
Oh, but I know what you're saying.
Once you put your capital in there, then your heart goes there. Then you start to study it. And then, and it doesn't mean you're always going to make money. But I tell you what, until you put capital, you just don't. I mean, look, before I was an entrepreneur, I didn't understand what, I mean, I was an executive at a very large company. We made lots of money. Let me tell you, fundamentally, there's a difference between getting an executive salary and all this kind of stuff. Then when you're your entrepreneur and you put your own capital in it, it's nothing you can get until you actually do it.
Until you do it. That's right. There's a phenomena. I don't know. I forget what the expression is called in psychology or in economics, behavioral economics. This is the analogy that I would draw. If you go out and you buy a, I don't know, do you even like cars or what kind of car do you?
I'm not a car guy.
We'll put it like this. I'll just tell the example. We have a Subaru Ascent. Now, my husband studied like crazy. He did consumer research, consumer reports. He did all these things. He said, honey, here, this is the one that I want, because I left that up to him. I don't care at all about cars. He said, this is it. This is a great car. It's very reliable. It has all the things and blah, 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 blah. So he said, let's buy a Subaru Ascent. I said, no problem. We bought the Subaru Ascent. First of all, we love this car, okay? There's no brand. I don't have anything to do whatsoever with Subaru. Tell you that I just love this car. It's amazing. But the second thing I'll say is, after we bought it, I noticed all the Subaru Ascents on the road. And I was like, oh, okay. So other people are like-minded who get it. And that's the same thing with your capital analogy. Yep. Like, yeah, put your money at stake. Because then you'll do your own research, your homework, you'll follow it more closely, and your eyes will be open to the possibilities. So I don't know what that's called in psychology.
Yeah, I know. There is a name. But let me, since you put a scripture out there, let me put my scripture on that one. Where your treasure is, therefore your heart will be. So what I'm trying to do it in the impact investing world is I'm trying to inspire people to say, go invest in Africa, go invest in affordable housing, go invest in whatever, whatever, because your heart will follow. And so for me, impact investing is, there's two sides to this. One is we need capital flowing to these areas to make a difference in the lives of those human beings and environment or whatever. But the other side, which is really my first motivation is, and you already said it, I want to change the heart of the investor. And so for me, I'll give you my dream real fast. In fact, I closed today on the very first property that I've been trying to do this for years. So my wife and I just closed on a duplex that will be used in conjunction with a prison ministry that these men and women, after they get released, who choose to stay around this area, they've been paying rent to somebody anyway. So now we will be their landlord. And the goal is for us to continue to acquire this types of real estate so that these men and women can have a high quality of housing and stay connected to this ministry. So what I really wanted is I want to take that concept, blow it up to a $2 billion REIT, because that's where I spent my life building REITs. Yes, I want to help these men and women, but I also want to change the hearts of those who view these men and women as something less than human. And when you put capital in it and they pay you rent and I send you a dividend check and I start writing about your performance and I start writing about stories of these individuals, guess what? You are going to see these men and women as different. And so going back to the original thing we talked about, you can change the system. Great. We need to change the system. It's still human beings that interact that whole system. So if we don't change the 200 million American hearts who've not been involved in the criminal justice system, then you're not going to change the system because you got to change hearts. So that's my little pitch. I'll get off of it, but you just teed me up and I'm like, wow.
First of all, let me just pause here for a moment, because not only do I want to slow down the conversation and honor you and tell you a massive kudos and congratulations, but I also want to speak to what you're creating at a higher level. So yes, you're creating fertile opportunities for investors to get an ROI in a very good business model. You're helping the former inmate to have a place to stay, which is stability is a super important thing for them. You're going to give them, I'm sure, a reasonable, you know, rent rates, that kind of thing. But really, you're helping the U.S. economy, because you're doing a number of things at once. You are reducing the rate of recidivism that is going to occur, because people who lack stability, who don't even have a roof over their head, or they can't even get a job. If they don't have an address to put on a job application, what does that look like for them? So you're expanding the range of possibilities for them. And by stopping or by diminishing the rate of recidivism in your area, who knows where they will go and get employment? Who knows what kind of fathers they will be able to be in the lives of their kids, how they'll be able to show up differently, the self-confidence and the respect, the self-respect that you will help them to generate. This is at a massive level. This is an investment play, yes, but it's a social play. It's an economic play. It's all of those things, because you started with an idea and you didn't dilly-dally about it. You said, I'm going to do it. And you committed capital. You saying you literally closed today on the property?
Literally, I wired the money today.
I love it.
And by the way, I've not even seen the property in person, which I would never do in a normal world. But because of relationships that have been built and whatnot, I'll go see it on Friday. Here's the other exciting part. So first of all, thank you for articulating all that so well. And it's way more powerful coming from you than it is from me. But you need to know, too, that today, and, you know, you get busy and you don't think about it. And I got 100 things going on. And on one hand, it's like, OK, here's this little money we're going to send over here. But honestly, God planted a seed in my heart when I was a freshman at Wheaton College, which would have been, I don't know, 34, 35 years ago.
Wow.
That, and I didn't know that specific thing, but that seed that God planted 35 years later is manifested into this today. And I can tell you, massive other things that it's manifested into that I had nothing to do other than I showed up. My wife and I will be blessed more than any person who stays in these houses will be. And guess what? Come fall, I mean, I don't know about this year, but my wife, I know her. She will be able to send Thanksgiving gifts, whatever it is, to connect with these people. We'll go see them, love on them. And it's just a beautiful thing for us. We're two are empty nesters. So yeah, I would say to that, because look, there's been many, 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 many discouraging moments over this whole thing. Not on this specific deal. In fact, it's the opposite. There's many, 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 many. And then this one's like literally, wait a second, this is truly happening? I mean, I didn't have smooth sailing. So now I'm not naive enough to say that there won't be some hard stuff, but it's a very cool thing. So thank you for acknowledging that. Okay. We're running long on time. I could talk to you forever. So let me just ask at least one question and then we'll wrap it up. I think this will be, I'm anxious to hear what you'll say. So no pressure. I mean, obviously we heard about your upbringing. Obviously you are out there teaching not only in the US, but eventually globally. And we'll need to follow up on this stuff afterwards because there's some stuff that we definitely should be talking together about. When did you realize the power of capital and what does that mean to you?
Honestly, I think I first realized the power of capital when I was a reporter for Dow Jones Newswires. So parent company, Wall Street Journal. And when I started as a reporter there in 1994, I think it was 1994. Yeah, 1994. They threw me into their most high profile beat, which was Wall Street. So I started writing about corporate finance and investment banking. I would cover IPOs. I would cover the brokerage industry. Now, mind you, before starting at Dow Jones, I literally could not have told you the difference between a stock and a bond. Okay. I knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about it. But I had a boss who believed in me. His name was Rick Stein. Great guy. And when he hired me, he said he was so impressed with me. He was like, oh my God, I love your clips. I had, you know, written for the Associated Press. I had written for Philadelphia Inquirer. And he said, I love your business stories. And I was like, what business stories is he talking about? Well, I had written about the aftermath of the riots in Los Angeles and Peter Ueberroth's Rebuild LA effort. But I thought I was just writing about community activities and whatnot. But really, it wasn't economic. It was a money story. But long story short, he said, Lynette, I said, Rick, you do realize I don't know about equities, about fixed income. He said, I can teach you that. Anybody can teach you that. He said, I can't teach you how to source. You have very great sources. I can't teach you how to write. You know how to write. I can't teach you how to listen and learn. You get it. He said, all the technical stuff, you can learn that. But you have the fundamental skills. He said, your storytelling is amazing. That's what I want. I want you to bring that to our industry and to what we're doing at Dow Jones. So I was like, okay. So I started covering not only investment banking, corporate finance, but I started seeing strategically companies that were listed and going public. And I was thinking, wow, look at all of this wealth creation that's happening. Look at how capital is flowing into these organizations at a massive level. And so that was really my introduction in the first way that I really saw how much not only capital just kind of flows and where the energy went in different areas, because you would have cycles and different sectors and industries that got hot or not. But it also showed me that, you know, a lot of this is at a personal level as well. Like when there were mergers and acquisitions, because I wrote a lot about M&A as well, oftentimes the thing that made the deal go sour and the deals that didn't work, it was egos, it was personality, it was the people involved. And so I saw how capital flow could be disrupted literally based on just like personality quirks and all of that. Yeah. And then I saw at a personal level also the power of capital at a much more reduced level in my own life and my own trajectory. And I'll just in 30 seconds summarize it. I've already shared that I grew up, you know, poor to very working class, to say the least. But long story short, in my late 20s and early 30s, and I'm in my 50s now, I got into massive amounts of debt. I had $100,000 in credit card debt. Long story short, I paid it all off in 3 years. I never missed a single payment. I wrote a book about it. It became a New York Times bestseller called Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom. So I saw how capital in different levels at a personal level, what it meant to be a borrower and what it meant to get out of it. And now as an investor, you were talking about properties and whatnot. My husband and I do invest in real estate as well. We own 8 properties, including our own, our primary residence, but then 7 rental properties as well. And yes, I know that committing capital, it requires a lot more of you. It requires your time, your attention, your passion, and your conviction. So it deepens all of those things. So anyway, that's what I would say about my sort of quick take about story with.
No, that's awesome. And I lied, I guess, because I just, there's one last question I got to ask you based on what you said. If you could get on CNBC, which I'm sure you've been on, whatever, if you could, whatever the highest level where you could have the loudest voice to Wall Street, whatever that means, do you have a simple message? What would you tell them?
I would say that some of the biggest opportunities have yet to be unearthed, and that they are in segments, populations, and areas where you're not currently playing. And that if you open the aperture a bit more, opportunity is everywhere, and that we're in a global environment, and that it's not only about, say, North America or Europe. Talent is distributed equally. Access may not be, opportunity sometimes may not be, but talent exists everywhere in the world. And to the extent that you tap into talent, it's the people, it's the creators, the people who are inspired through God, through their own experiences, through whatever means to drive a lot of this innovation and a lot of this opportunity. So I would say open your minds to the possibilities, and a rising tide really can lift all boats.
If I could reach through, I'd give you a big hug right now. And we've got a lot to talk about, because I actually think, and I'm sure you know this, what you just articulated is why your network has the ability to be so powerful. You know why? Because they can move faster than Wall Street and they can think outside the box. And so to harness that, the investors, again, there's from a disclosure, there's still risk. I think they'll reap extra benefits, and the connection that they'll have with what they're investing in. And frankly, I think what our world has to do is we have decoupled our investment strategies from people and how it's impacting people. And I can tell you what, the moment we start actually saying, hey, here are your financial returns, but then let's also talk about how did that capital get used for the benefit of others, for the benefit. And when you start having that, I think you're going to really start to see things shift in a way that not only is great for an investor, but then I hopefully, if culture's in the right spot and morals are in the right spot, you actually can start to move and massively shift things. And point blank, that to me is what's happening in the world right now. There's this battle of good and evil. And it's like, how are we going to allocate this capital? And so the real question is how does one define good? For another time, I'd love to talk about that. But Lynette, this was so awesome. I love what you had to say. I love your straight, clear message. You've got a beautiful shirt on and that color. And I'll just say it radiates what's inside in your heart. And it is very clear that you are living for your family, but you're also living for things that are much bigger than yourself. And it's just very clear. So please be affirmed that I talked to a lot of people and your enthusiasm, excitement, hope, just oozes through this computer and microphone.
Oh, thank you for that. And I am passionate about it because I really do love what I'm doing and what I'm continuing to do, even, you know, decades into it. I just see so much opportunity, so many points of connection. And like I said, truly God wastes nothing. I am increasingly of the belief that our job is to figure it all out, to figure that he's put all this before us. And now you just got to connect the dots. Just, you know, and so I'm in a happy space. So if you're feeling that energy or that positivity radiating through the screen, it's as a result of that, you know?
Well, and where you're going, hopefully, we got to make sure if we've not fully connected it. I've seen some. You need to see my brother in Rwanda. But I mean, even that, just to weigh the end of this discussion, you look at Rwanda that had one of the worst genocides that you could ever imagine. You will go there. I've been there. You can't articulate what has happened in Rwanda since that 30 years ago. And I really believe that America needs to study what Rwanda has done because, and I will tell you, one of the strongest things I heard in the back of a taxi cab when I was talking to a gentleman who today is maybe 35, his best friend at the time, so they were maybe 5'7", the best friend, his dad killed the other friend's dad. What I asked him in the back of the car, what would you tell Americans? He said, two things. Don't think this can't happen to you, and you have to forgive. And look where they are today.
And look where they are. I will say this in closing about Rwanda. One of the reasons that this is the first place internationally that we want to expand our business. And again, we've been to, you know, 40, 45 countries maybe or so. Not only beyond transformational, in 31 short years since the genocide, they've made a commitment. They literally said, we choose reconciliation over revenge. And the mindset and the ethos that is pervasive throughout the country, one of national unity, you're not going to get them, if you ask somebody, oh, is your family Hutu or Tutsi? They're like, no. We're Rwandans, you know, and people who come here, if you want to adapt and come into our life and live in the country, you're Rwandans too. So, but they did something remarkable in terms of putting people first, as you said, at every level, business, clean energy, housing, business transformation in terms of opening up opportunities for people outside of the country to come and invest and make it easy for us to do so. But they also said, listen, in the context of us all sort of rebuilding together over their 3+ decades, they told the truth. They had confessionals, tribunals. The way that they got past it was to have a reckoning and is to say, we had this horrible, horrific thing that happened and we never want it to be repeated. So they have Kwibuka every year where they will, in April, remember what happened. They don't sugarcoat it. They don't whitewash it. So a lot of European countries have, in fact, looked at Rwanda as a model for reconciliation and how you get past really catastrophic things. But here in the U.S., unfortunately, we're 400 years past from when Black people came to this country, you know, 160+ years from the end of the Civil War, 1861 to 65. We've never had an honest conversation, a reckoning to say, can we forgive and move on? Can we just, you know, can we all get along as Rodney King said, you know? But we will not until we have an honest and candid conversation. And I think that that's so much of in the roots of their society about why. And when you see what happened subsequent, it's almost like, of course it worked because they gave everybody a chance to air their grievances, to get it out, to be done, and then and to say, now let's move on, you know, kind of thing. So that also appeals to me. because it's accountability, it's honesty, it's candor, and you're not the only one. I talk to people also who had the same thing. This person killed another family member, but now they're married or the families are very close. But you don't get there without having that kind of a reckoning and not sort of glossing over it.
Yeah. And last comment, this is not a political comment. Some might take it, but I don't really care. Look, what we saw 2 weeks ago, whatever the math was, when Erica, I think that's her name, Kirk, addressed the country and said, "I forgive that shooter." I literally came off the couch and I'm like, "Oh, that is a message that we all need. We need to learn to forgive. We need to learn to forgive everyone. I mean, we've all been wrong. I don't care what, but if you carry it with you, and look, I'm preaching myself. I'm the one who's going to suffer for it if I carry it.
That's why they say when you have vengeance in your heart, dig two graves. It's not just the other person. You're eroding, eating away. You're taking away your own humanity, your focus, your energy. And hate, it just eats away. It doesn't build, edify, lift up, or make anything positive grow. So yeah, we absolutely do need forgiveness at a lot of levels.
Well, thank you so much.
I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, well, yes, likewise. So until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. Look forward to having more guests. We will put on our show how to connect with you and how to access all your information. So again, thanks so much and have a wonderful rest of the day. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.